Blog Talk Radio.
You, I fight myself, I fight God to tell me how many burdens left. I fight pain and hurricanes, today I wept. I'm trying to fight back tears, blood on my doorstep. Life is living hell, puddles of blood in the street. Shooters on top of the building, government aid ain't relief. Earthquake, the body drop, the ground breaks. The poor run with smoke lungs and scarred face. Who need a hero?
Hero.
You need a hero, look in the mirror, there go your hero. Who on the front lines at ground zero?
Hero.
My heart don't skip a beat even when hard times bumps the needle. Mass destruction and mass corruption, the souls of suffering men. Clutching on deaf ears again, rapture's coming. It's all prophecy, and if I gotta be sacrificed for the greater good, then that's what it gotta
you
be.
Pray for me.
Country and into more countries, fast eyes burst into rhythm. Where's the ghost?
down to Baba, then went down to Peachtree. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes.
Now I see the importance of history. Why my people be in the mess that they be. Many journeys to freedom made in vain by brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me without the enlightenment of all my folks. He said, cause I set myself on a quest for truth and you was there to quench my thirst. But I am still thirsty. Lord, allow me to drink some more. He said, what I am searching for are the answers to all which are in front of me. The ultimate truth started to get blurry. Some strange reason it had to be. It was all a dream about Tennessee.
This is Real Talk, Real Game.
Time reigned in a country a great way off, where there were in those days fairies. Now this king and queen had plenty of money, and plenty of fine clothes to wear, and plenty of good things to eat and drink, and a coach to ride out in every day. But though they had been married many years, they had no children, and this grieved them very much indeed. But one day, as the queen was walking by the side of the river at the bottom of the garden, she saw a poor little fish that had thrown itself out of the water and lay gasping and nearly dead on the bank. Then the queen took pity on the little fish and threw it back again into the river. And before it swam away, it lifted its head out of the water and said, "I know what your wish is. And it shall be fulfilled in return for your kindness to me. You will soon have a daughter." What the little fish had foretold soon came to pass, and the queen had a little girl, so very beautiful that the king could not cease looking on it for joy, and said he would hold a great feast and make merry and show the child to all the land. So he asked his kinsmen and nobles and friends and neighbors. But the queen said, "I will have the fairies also, that they might be kind and good to our little daughter." Now, there were 13 fairies in the kingdom, but as the king and queen had only 12 golden dishes for them to eat out of, they were forced to leave one of the fairies without asking her. So 12 fairies came, each with a high red cap on her head and red shoes with high heels on her feet and a long white wand in her hand. And after the feast was over, they gathered round in a ring and gave all their best gifts to the little princess. One gave her goodness, another beauty, another riches, and so on till she had all that was good in the world. Just as 11 of them had done blessing her, a great noise was heard in the courtyard, and word was brought that the 13th fairy was come, with a black cap on her head, and black shoes on her feet, and a broomstick in her hand. And presently, up she came into the dining hall. Now, as she had not been asked to the feast, she was very angry, and scolded the king and queen very much, and set to work to take her revenge. So she cried out, "The king's daughter shall, in her 15th year, be wounded by a spindle, and fall down dead." Then the 12th of the friendly fairies, who had not yet given her gift, came forward, and said that the evil wish must be fulfilled, but that she could soften its mischief. So her gift was that the king's daughter, when the spindle wounded her, should not really die, but should only fall asleep for 100 years. However, the king hoped still to save his dear child altogether from the threatened evil. So he ordered that all the spindles in the kingdom should be bought up and burnt. But all the gifts of the first 11 fairies were in the meantime fulfilled, for the princess was so beautiful and well-behaved and good and wise that everyone who knew her loved her. It happened that on the very day she was 15 years old, the king and queen were not at home, and she was left alone in the palace. So she roved about by herself and looked at all the rooms and chambers, till at last she came to an old tower, to which there was a narrow staircase ending with a little door. In the door, there was a golden key, and when she turned it, the door sprang open, and there sat an old lady, spinning away very busily. "Why, how now, good mother?" said the princess. "What are you doing there?"
"Spinning," said the old lady, and nodded her head, humming a tune, while on went the wheel.
"How prettily that little thing turns round," said the princess, and took the spindle and began to try and spin. But scarcely had she touched it before the fairy's prophecy was fulfilled. The spindle wounded her, and she fell down lifeless on the ground. However, she was not dead, but had only fallen into a deep sleep, and the king and the queen, who had just come home, and all their court fell asleep too, and the horses slept in the stables, and the dogs in the court, the pigeons on the housetop, and the very flies slept upon the walls. Even the fire on the hearth left off blazing and went to sleep. The jack stopped, and the spit that was turning about with the goose upon it for the king's dinner stood still, and the cook, who was at that moment pulling the kitchen boy by the hair to give him a box on the ear for something he had done amiss, let him go, and both fell asleep. The butler, who was slyly tasting the ale, fell asleep with the jug at his lips, and thus everything stood still and slept soundly. A large hedge of thorns soon grew around the palace, and every year it became higher and thicker, till at last the old palace was surrounded and hidden, so that not even the roof or the chimneys could be seen. But there went a report through all the land of the beautiful sleeping Briar Rose, for so the king's daughter was called, so that from time to time several king's sons came and tried to break through the thicket into the palace. This, however, none of them could ever do, for the thorns and bushes laid hold of them, as it were with hands, and there they stuck fast and died wretchedly. After many, many years, there came a king's son into that land, and an old man told him the story of the thicket of thorns, and how a beautiful palace stood behind it, and how a wonderful princess called Briar Rose lay in it asleep with all her court. He told, too, how he had heard from his grandfather that many, many princes had come and had tried to break through the thicket, but that they had all stuck fast in it and died.
Then the young prince said, "All this shall not frighten me. I will go and see this Briar Rose." The old man tried to hinder him, but he was bent upon going. Now that very day, the 100 years were ended, and as the prince came to the thicket, he saw nothing but beautiful flowering shrubs, through which he went with ease, and they shut in after him as thick as ever. Then he came at last to the palace, and there in the court lay the dogs asleep, and the horses were standing in the stables, and on the roof sat the pigeons, fast asleep, with their heads under their wings. And when he came into the palace, the flies were sleeping on the walls. The spit was standing still. The butler had the jug of ale at his lips, going to drink a draught. The maid sat with a fowl in her lap, ready to be plucked. And the cook in the kitchen was still holding up her hand as if she was going to beat the boy. Then he went on still farther, and all was so still that he could hear every breath he drew, till at last he came to the old tower and opened the door of the little room in which Briar Rose was. And there she lay, fast asleep on a couch by the window. She looked so beautiful that he could not take his eyes off her, so he stooped down and gave her a kiss. But the moment he kissed her, she opened her eyes and awoke, and smiled upon him, and they went out together, and soon the king and queen also awoke, and all the court, and gazed on each other with great wonder, and the horses shook themselves, and the dogs jumped up and barked. The pigeons took their heads from under their wings and looked about and flew into the fields. The flies on the wall buzzed again. The fire in the kitchen blazed up. Round went the jack, and round went the spit with the goose for the king's dinner upon it. The butler finished his draught of ale. The maid went on plucking the fowl, and the cook gave the boy the box on his ear. And then the prince and Briar Rose were married, and the wedding feast was given, and they lived happily together all their lives long. The end.
your brother.
You gotta dig under the music. You gotta dig under the dance. You gotta get under what caused these things to exist to know the true history. And why do you want the true history? Because there are real secrets in the history that empower your life. And this is why you need to know this. Hip hop is holding ancient secrets. I'm gonna share this with you right now. Here's the ancient secrets, most ancient. Those that study philosophy or anyone on a spiritual path, really, in that sense, may recognize some of what I'm getting ready to talk about. But I have to go here with you because here's the number two of it. First, the charitable act, the self-expression, the courage to be you causes hip-hop. If that's the act that brings it into physical manifestation. I'm going to be me no matter what. Now, here's the next step. After you've decided to really be the real you, which has a consequence, to be the real me, I may have to leave home. To be the real me, I may have to divorce her. To be the real me, I may have to leave him, them, it. To be the real me is going to be a consequence. But if you can get the courage up to be you, here's the next step. Where are you? You say, I'm going to be me. Well, where are you? Where is me? Who is me? What does me look like? I'm going to be me. What is me? Self-creation is the second part to hip hop. We created ourselves. The mainstream had nothing to do with it. They didn't want to have nothing to do with it. That's why it's such a farce now. I wake up every day laughing at the TV that rap artists and a lot, I can't even say just rappers, hip-hop culture is all over the mainstream.
Going down the drain.
Look, and it is. Because at the end of the day, we were created as an answer to the mainstream. The mainstream said you dance like this. You hold your partner by the waist and by the hand, and you do this kind of thing, you know, and you dance back and forth. We said, no, we spinning, popping, we doing something different, and we gonna beat it. No, you're supposed to play, you're supposed to buy a record, put it on the turntable, you put the needle on the record, you step away from the turntable, let the record play. We're like, no, you got to play with the record while it's playing, and this is how you get the sound. They're like, no, you're supposed to sing into a microphone, you're supposed to have this kind of, you know, and everything that the mainstream said was right and true, we said, it's not. Why? It just don't feel right. Now, here's the magical lesson of the day. To get in touch with your feelings, with your intuition, with your me, with your I. To really get in touch with that. On top of that, you heard yourself speaking. Yet this ear is not what heard. The only way this ear can hear is by vibration. This other voice that you have spoke and heard itself speaking. Yet the ear nor the mouth was used. This is the beginning of your spiritual awareness. That there is another you
that operates within this physical body. As a matter of fact, it's not even within it, it's everywhere. There's another you that is not confined to this body. It actually can manipulate it and tell it what to do and go and be. There's another you, a real me, a real I, that can speak, can hear, and can see without anything physical. You can close your eyes. If you close your eyes, you can see this term better. These are just symbols. These scratchings are just symbols that point to a reality. When you close your eyes, you can see the reality that this symbol is pointing you to. You can actually see better with your eyes closed. What is the sight that sees your future? It's not these eyes. But yet you see your future. You see your past. You can actually see your past. But it's not these eyes that are actually seeing you. So what is sight? It's not just eye, it's not talk, it's not just mouth, hearing is not just ear. There is an inner thing going on that once you become in tune with the voice that doesn't speak, the hearing that doesn't hear, doesn't need to hear, the sight that doesn't need to see, when you get in touch with that, you're at the center of where hip-hop lives. Hip-hop doesn't come from the physical world. Hip-hop is not a physical thing. The term hip-hop never comes into physical reality, ever. Hip-hop influences us to bring it into physical reality. This is why we say we are not just doing hip-hop, we are hip-hop. Because the only time hip-hop comes into physical manifestation is when you allow it to. Hip-hop, the term, remains a collective idea. This is an idea that we are all sharing called hip-hop. But that idea never came. There is nothing that I can pick up and say, this is hip-hop. This is a can of hip-hop. Or this animal is called hip-hop. Or this, you know, there is no physical thing that you can say, this is hip-hop. Hip-hop is an idea. And that idea, the second level of that idea, is self-creation. You have to know where the I is in order to create it. You have to know who me is in order to create it.
Thank you. voices in my head saying I could do better. Damn. Voices in my head saying that I knew better. Yeah. I done seen this shit happen 100 times on the regular, but I still cross the line like I'm blind. Damn, voices in my head saying I could do better. Yeah. This was supposed to be the last time, last hit, last call, last feel, last trip, last run. That's what I always tell myself, huh? This was supposed to be the last one, last two, last flip, last you, last me, last night. Doing every single thing my parents want me about, till I'm worn out. Voices in my head saying I could do better. Voices in my head saying that I knew better. I done seen this shit happen 100 times on the regular. But I still, voices in my head, conscious talking to me like,
Mr. Woman wants some more. Stick to the plan, stick to the plan, stick to the plan, bitch quit plan, stick to the plan, to the plan, stick to the plan. Everything else you know,
make sure all your interactions in with actions. If you stack in front and back and subtract, if it isn't adding, plus who hurt you, don't let back and plan it out. Yeah, tip for that and extra pussy, get distracted, put that in the what's worth having.
Boy, stick to the plan, stick to the plan, stick to the plan, bitch quit plan, stick to the plan, to the plan. Pay attention who you're getting close to. Distance yourself from negative energy.
Voices in my head, they say it's meant for me. I, you in my way, bitch, it's no sympathy. I, been plotting this since elementary.
No, you need to buckle down. Have people asking where you at and wondering why you never wanna come around. You know that effort gon' come around.
Big face like Zordon. You bought the watch but can't afford the time. Even if you running out of breath. Weight of the world doing lots of reps. Time to get this generation last one and then the next two out of debt. And they gon' pay you back with respect. Just stick to the plan still. We can still. Back when I rocked the white and blue Grand Hill, I realized there's no dream that I can't feel. I manifested all while I'm the man still. Voices in my head attacking what I'm thinking. Bullet to the head might be the way to free it.
If I leave my body, I can free the spirit.
Swear to God, my death of fear just keep on shrinking. Wishing I could go back to the 90s, back when I was dreaming. Me and my dog was on a mission like we Kellen Keenan. Early 2000s, Detroit might as well been in hell with demons. Wondering when I started losing it, then losing grip. Feeling like I'm in the middle of the ocean. You either drown or canoe through it. Voices in my head till I'm used to it. Some of me to losing, some help me maneuver through it. When I talk to myself, I'm confused on who's who it. I know in life you either blow it or blew it. And at the end of life, it's gonna feel like you flew through it. I just hope I did not cut the voices in my head.
Rumpelstiltskin. By the side of a wood, in a country a long way off, ran a fine stream of water, and upon the stream there stood a mill. The miller's house was close by, and the miller, you must know, had a very beautiful daughter. She was, moreover, very shrewd and clever, and the miller was so proud of her that he one day told the king of the land, who used to come and hunt in the wood, that his daughter could spin gold out of straw. Now this king was very fond of money, and when he heard the miller's boast, his greediness was raised, and he sent for the girl to be brought before him. Then he led her to a chamber in his palace where there was a great heap of straw, and gave her a spinning wheel and said, "All this must be spun into gold before morning, as you love your life." It was in vain that the poor maiden said that it was only a silly boast of her father, for
that she could do no such thing as spin straw into gold. The chamber door was locked, and she was left alone. She sat down in one corner of the room and began to bewail her hard fate, when on a sudden the door opened, and a droll-looking little man hobbled in and said, "Good morrow to you, my good lass. What are you weeping for?" "Alas," said she, "I must spin this straw into gold, and I know not how." "What will you give me," said the hobgoblin, "to do it for you?" "My necklace," replied the maiden. He took her at her word and sat himself down to the wheel and whistled and sang, round about, lo and behold, reel away, straw into gold. And round about the wheel went merrily. The work was quickly done, and the straw was all spun into gold. When the king came and saw this, he was greatly astonished and pleased. But his heart grew still more greedy of gain, and he shut up the poor miller's daughter again with a fresh task. Then she knew not what to do, and sat down once more to weep. But the dwarf soon opened the door and said, "What will you give me to do your task?" "The ring on my finger," said she. So her little friend took the ring and began to work at the wheel again, and whistled and sang, round about, lo and behold, reel away, straw into gold, till, long before morning, all was done again. The king was greatly delighted to see all this glittering treasure, but still he had not enough. So he took the miller's daughter to a yet larger heap and said, "All this must be spun tonight, and if it is, you shall be my queen." As soon as she was alone, that dwarf came in and said, "What will you give me to spin gold for you this third time?" "I have nothing left," said she. "Then say you will give me," said the little man, "the first little child that you may have when you are queen." "That may never be," thought the miller's daughter, and as she knew no other way to get her task done, she said she would do what he asked. Round went the wheel again to the old song, and the mannikin once more spun the heap into gold. The king came in the morning, and, finding all he wanted, was forced to keep his word. So he married the miller's daughter, and she really became queen.
That nigga E-40. Gonna sprinkle some of you fools with some of this G-A-M-E, man, some of this guy. Understand my sister. Gonna sprinkle you fools with my sprinkler system. Understand this stuff. It don't stop you, the motherfucking Glock pop. And fuck a Glock, I'm fucking with the 6R. P226, Diana Ross, cousin Nina. Mr. Meter, that's what we do. Understand it. I'll be more hipper than the hippopotamus. Get off in your head like a neurologist. Push him awake than Atlas. Got a fight about the name of Tupacalus. The 707 Marisco, hella fall back to floor terrace.
Yeah.
I pull a 40 out of my bar cap and then I flush it down my esophagus. The group that I'm with, the click. Sugar D shot legit.
Yeah.
Family orientated, game related, it's the shit.
Yeah.
Killing motherfuckers off crucial. Sitting them down mutual. Running through these lyrics as if I was fiber. Like Metamuso.
Timer, timer. Body water.
Sprinkle me, man.
Big timer, timer.
Big time.
Body water.
Sprinkle me, man. Kick that shit.
Here comes the top notch. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Here I be. Clipped out nations of tea from the beat. I'm quick to smile. Always down for the job. You gotta strut, that's a gang shot.
Why?
Most folks tell me, why? Sugar, you ain't right.
You ain't
on no player making mega. Trying to knock the hustle just because we way too major.
They try to test your testicles, you know that shit ain't cool.
Sure, you don't make it happen. I'm about to sound cool and act a fucking fool.
All these old whole cake ass niggas, they make me so damn sick.
Boom, 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 boom,
boom on the track.
Play a player for false and get rubbed off. You don't want moss, don't want moss. Fuck around and get evaporated. Cause I'm a timer, timer.
Timer, timer.
What's happening, shit? You and this bitch with me?
I thought you
were. Yeah,
heard.
That's what we do for the motherfucking 9-5.
For the 9-5. Yeah.
Sick with the records. Jive all the time.
Understanding the system, man.
Mob City, B Town. Mob City. Mob City, B Town, man.
Mob is in your hood.
You're listening to Real Talk, Real Game on Black Noise Radio.
Outlawing mortals, bow down to something greater than yourself, Trick. Individually capable of enormous amounts of chin checks and eye swords. They ain't no. You watching, but you ain't seeing what lies before you, biatch. Picture, if you will, seven deadly human beings blessed with the gift of speech, the power to reach each nigga on every street. May the heavenly father look down and be proud of what transpired since the day the seed was planted. The G group, but we knew we'd have a click. Smoked out, looked out, all in this shit. Just me and my dogs living like homies. I don't know more. What follows is the story. What preceded was the clue. The last thing in the fiction. Don't fuck around and make it shit.
My adversary stumble when we rumble with the catastrophe. I put my bands on big niggas that blasted me. Plus my alias is Machiavelli. 357 with hollow points to a nigga belly. Plus him and see if he bleed. He should have never fucked around with a sick ass nigga like me. They call my name out, niggas run. Bless you, prepared for the outlaws when we come.
They call me Hussein Faye. It's a two game take. I'm robbing your niggas cradle with a knife in your navel. Rap related, criminally activated and evil. I wouldn't want to be.
Young nigga.
cause if they want something, so I'ma come and sit down for something. I'ma stop up while my beat is bumping, talking to my fucking last line. When low on the cash flow, who you think was on that ass? So don't ask them. I already know them doing the dinner on the side, so ain't no sense of how I won't be robbed.
My alien could drop. Trump talks so fast, can't copy. 6 green copy, quick to hit your bitch and she dropped. Civilian addicted to living like a fucking felon. My beat with rookie cops, the cookie rocks, the nigga selling. Sister Shorty, I've been living like the fine. Nickel plated chrome, got this baby cologne, looking like a giant. Can I ain't lying? It's like it's me against myself with all these X and snakes grabbing at my fucking web.
More company called terrorists. The bottom of the river where the body lay. I'm back, nigga, with the fake cab cap. With the murderous stack, Betty Creek. Why these motherfuckers be deep? It's been a long road, a lot of episodes. And as the clock blows, I got a deep toes. Deep toes make a friendly nigga with a mask. Now I'm passing in the assassin. Thugs, nigga, till we die. No mercy on these play ass and bitches that we buy. Outlaw Immortals, baby.
What?
Y'all niggas same face, it's so crazy.
AC.
Machiavelli, Hussein, Castro, Gaddafi, Mussolini, Amin, Napoleon, Khomeini.
Y'all niggas, what y'all really want to do?
Like them niggas said,
what the
would you do?
Yeah,
okay, folks, once again, it's on.
Rumpelstiltskin. By the side of a wood, in a country a long way off, ran a fine stream of water. And upon the stream there stood a mill. The miller's house was close by, and the miller, you must know, had a very beautiful daughter. She was, moreover, very shrewd and clever, and the miller was so proud of her that he one day told the king of the land, who used to come and hunt in the wood, that his daughter could spin gold out of straw. Now this king was very fond of money, and when he heard the miller's boast, his greediness was raised. And he sent for the girl to be brought before him. Then he led her to a chamber in his.
Hello, greetings. Welcome to Attaining the Second Cognition. This is Doug Michael. Thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen, for taking your time to join me. I want to give a thank you to all my subscribers. Thank you so much for opening your mind and taking the time to consider this information. It's truly deeply appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, this presentation is very heavily picture-laden, so you may find yourself having to use the pause button as the video progresses in regard to looking at the images presented so you can digest them better. This video presentation is going to be a very fast-paced episode to tell just a part of a massive story in a short period of time, so I ask my listeners and subscribers to be patient as the synopsis unfolds because we're going to cover a lot of ground in this video. Ever since archaeologists started unearthing sites in ancient Mesopotamia, what is known in modern times as Iraq, they found ancient writings from one of the earliest civilizations in which writing was developed. With the excavation of these ancient sites, archaeologists have unearthed literally hundreds of thousands of clay tablets inscribed in cuneiform characters, which were carved into these clay tablets with sharp styluses. These clay tablets came in many different shapes and sizes. These clay tablets had everything from temple inventories legal contracts, divorce records, bills of sale, and on the larger tablets, their religious and ceremonial liturgies and hymns and stories of their gods and heroes, often referred to as epics. With the public release of Zechariah Sitchin's Earth Chronicles series of books, starting with his book The Twelfth Planet in 1976, the stories of the ancient Sumerian Anunna gods found their way into the mainstream consciousness. With Sitchin's books, the world beyond the realm of academia finally learned about the tales of the ancient Anunnaki gods. Unfortunately, Sitchin took a lot of liberties through creating his own translations to many of these ancient texts, and thereby misdirected the public down the road of cognitive misdirection. It is due to this misdirection that Endel did his own deep research into the matter, which led to his writing of the books We Are Not Alone, Part 1, 2, and 3, in an attempt to set the record straight based on the available evidence and through using strictly mainstream academic translations of the ancient Mesopotamian writings. Now, what his research unearthed does not remotely paint the same picture that Sitchin told his audience, and that is the basis for this presentation, off-world influence blowing the Anunnaki story wide open. Now, people who are not familiar with the difficulties of archaeology are not really aware of the painstaking and time-consuming nature of that work. It can sometimes take decades to unearth an ancient civilization, and the larger the discovery is, the longer it takes to carefully excavate a site, catalog its inventory, and eventually translate whatever textual evidence may be unearthed. The cuneiform tablets, as just noted, literally numbered in the hundreds of thousands, and it is unknown how many such tablets lie in museums still waiting to be translated, and many of those that have been translated, a goodly percentage in German, are not translated into English for any untold number of reasons. Given what this video is about to reveal, if those tablets contain any of the information that can verify what is in this video and Endel's three-volume set, then it is little wonder why it is being kept under wraps. To be fair and honest, Zechariah Sitchin did get part of his storytelling right. The Anunnaki did not originate on this planet. They were created by a race of beings who were master geneticists, and they were a hybrid race combining the genetics of humans and a variety of fish from another planet that orbits periodically into and out of our solar system. This planet is known as Nibiru, and its presumed story is found all over the internet when you see any video about Planet X. What many of my viewers and subscribers may have run across if they've looked into any of these alleged Planet X videos is a shrill and contrived means of propaganda warning humanity of the presumed imminent return of Planet X any day now. Such hype is just another scare tactic put forth by the consortium disinformation agents for reasons that only they know. I would not put any store in such stories, as they are only being aired to create another form of fear programming in the minds of those that give the idea any credence. As for the circumstances surrounding the creation of the Anunnaki, I refer my listeners to Endel's We Are Not Alone books for greater detail, as the information goes beyond the scope of this presentation. And ladies and gentlemen, I do understand how shocking this information may seem, but if you give it a chance, and I definitely recommend checking out Endel's books, We Are Not Alone 1, 2, and 3, he really makes a compelling case for this, so please bear with me. Now, we have one source of information describing these beings from the writings of the Babylonian priest Berossus. At Babylon, there was, in these times, a great resort of people of various nations who inhabited Chaldea and lived in a lawless manner, like the beasts of the field. In the first year, there appeared from that part of the Erythian Sea, which borders upon Babylonia, an animal destitute of reason by name Ohms, whose whole body, according to the account of Apollodorus, was that of a fish, that under the fish's head he had another head, with feet also below, similar to those of a man subjoined to the fish's tail. His voice, too, and language was articulate and human, and a representation of him is preserved even to this day. For those who wish to challenge this assertion that the Anunnaki were a hybrid race of gene-spliced human and fish genetics, images and carvings abound throughout the Fertile Crescent of their presence. When you couple these multitudes of carvings on temple walls and the statuettes that abound throughout the entire Near and Middle East, it gets pretty difficult to just assume that this was nothing more than some kind of superstitious belief system. You will find variants of this hybridization in many images worldwide. We have to ask ourselves why these images are found in such abundance, and we even find less defined, more ancient references from the Indus Valley in India all the way to Africa. If these hybrid fish beings were remotely mythical, then we have to ask why representations of them are carved in temple walls in as much abundance as they have been, unless they had a greater meaning than our science has yet figured out. Or maybe our esteemed scientists just don't want to admit this ugly truth. Of course, it's possible they already know all about it and are doing their damnedest to intentionally keep this knowledge from the public at large. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if that idea is hard to accept, and I must admit, it was hard for me to accept at first, too, until I really gave the information a chance and really mulled it over. Just look at what our geneticists are doing today. It's been publicly admitted that they've been combining human DNA with fish DNA and also, you know, other types of creatures as well. So our geneticists today are doing this, combining different genes from different species. So who's to say that an ancient advanced race with a masterful knowledge of genetics weren't able to do this, to mix their own genes with that of the predominant human species on the planet at the time? When deciphering these Sumerian, Babylonian, and Akkadian tablets, archaeologists are often left with broken tablets to try and translate what was carved in the clay. As you can see by the images, it's impossible to translate what may be on these broken tablets. So many archaeologists are only able to piece these stories together when they find the same story written on tablets from different excavations that may not be damaged in the same places. When they discover these stories in different ancient sites, then they can often piece together the full text when the copies are compared. Modern scientists and geneticists utterly deny that such a hybrid fish-human species could exist because they have not yet managed to do cross-species gene splicing themselves, but don't think for a minute that it is due to lack of trying on their part. This fish symbology is also found in India with the god Vishnu in this first incarnation as a merman. But there is a history in India at one time of two kingdoms called the Matsya kingdoms, one in central India, which was the center of patriarchal Brahmin worship, and one in the south, which was primarily dedicated to goddess worship. Matsya translates to mean fish. Again, the story of the wars between these two fish kingdoms goes beyond the scope of this video, but is covered in part two of Engel's books, We Are Not Alone. With the establishment of the fact that these hybrid creatures did in fact exist, and the fact that they find their imagery in cultures all around the planet, then we have to view just what this information may mean to us, if anything. As Engel related in his We Are Not Alone books, there were specifically two of these Anunnaki hybrids that set themselves up as overlords over the other Anunnaki, and they set themselves up as gods over humans on this planet. The earliest Sumerian texts relate the fact that the Anunnaki themselves were a created race, created by a race of beings whom they refer to as the Elder Gods. It is this same race of Elder Gods that created the Anunnaki in a genetic gene splicing experiment, who also created the human race on this planet much later than the Anunnaki in a genetic laboratory roughly 200,000 years ago. In time, there was a war between the Anunnaki and the Elder Gods for control of this planet, in which the Anunnaki ultimately triumphed. The two premier gods of the Anunnaki pantheon were ultimately known as Enki and his sister Ninhursag. It is the competition between these two powerful Anunnaki hybrids that is at the root of all the conflict on this planet to this day. Enki was the patriarchal god wherever he gained control. Ninhursag played the role of the mother goddess wherever she held power. These two fish hybrids continually warred with each other, with both of them ultimately seeking to singularly rule humanity in their own style. They would occasionally cooperate when it suited them, but generally evolved back into conflict any time their need for collaboration ended, exactly like the consortium elite do to this day. This is not by accident. Because of the genetic hybridization process, the Anunnaki did not create a stable breed and found themselves subject to many and varied types of birth defects. When they bred with humans on this planet, and don't think for a minute that they didn't, it created a more human-type hybrid race with less-than-human characteristics. As these skulls plainly show, there were numerous forms of Anunnaki-human crossbreeding mistakes and birth defects. The most prominent evidence of this Anunnaki human crossbreeding is found with what is commonly known as elongated skulls. Before getting to the pictures of these skulls, I want to take a moment and clarify an erroneous assessment. If you can envision these Anunnaki being combined fish and human hybrids with the characteristics of a fish running the full length of their bodies with a human face under the fish head as shown previously, then when you view these images, you can see what academics call horned helmets are in fact gill structures. It takes very little imagination to see these representations as gill structures and less than horned helmet conjecture that the academics claim it represents when this imagery is viewed from a broader perspective. As the Anunnaki bred with humans, as noted, they created a race of beings with inordinately elongated skulls. As you can tell by these images, these are not your normal human skulls. These elongated skulls have been found worldwide, and their existence in many cases is kept from the public eye. In the not-too-distant past, they had a display of these skulls in a museum in Malta, and they eventually removed the display because they simply creeped people out too much. It doesn't really matter which side of the equation you may rely on, the interpretation of religion or that of science, the fact is that the existence of these skulls are a major anomaly. If God created humans in his image, then what do these skulls represent? If you are a Darwinian materialist scientist, then your Darwinian tree of evolution is going to have to grow a few more branches to account for the existence of these skulls in the abundance they exist. I find it interesting that the Darwinists can find the pieces of a single skull and then reach the erroneous conclusion that one skull or skeleton can establish and support their entire theory of evolution. You have to realize that Darwin's evolutionary theory is only that, an unproven theory that gives materialist scientism a form of cognitive comfort, thinking they have it all figured out. The story of the Piltdown Man is one of the Darwinists' greatest embarrassments. At the time of the discovery of the Piltdown Man, science was really pushing for acceptance of Darwin's evolutionary theory. The whole thing turned out to be a gigantic hoax, but it took science 40 years to come forward and finally admit that it was a hoax. When we look at the scarcity of evidence presented by the materialist Darwinists in comparison to the wealth of these elongated skulls that have been dug up all around the planet and how science is utterly seeking to ignore their existence because it throws Darwinism straight into the trash bin, then we're confronted with a consortium cover-up of gigantic proportions. If you are lucky, you will see one of these skulls shown in Ancient Aliens or some other program of propaganda, but materialist scientists are keeping this subject away from public discussion, except to the tinfoil hat-wearing crowd of alien and UFO cults. How science justifies the existence of these enigmatic skulls is by using the excuse of skull binding, where certain cultures bind the skulls of their children in order to make them somehow more appealing, or to honor the gods who also had these elongated skulls. Because so many of these skulls have been found in South and Central America, the practice of skull binding is best known within the Mayan culture. Skull binding is a known practice, and it has served as an easy misdirection for scientists to sidestep the issue of these elongated skulls, allowing scientists to dismiss all of these elongated skulls with the convenient excuse of skull binding, but their theory of skull binding being accountable for all of these elongated skulls evaporates when you have a baby skull too young to be found that appears. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that pretty much screws up the whole skull binding theory as the only explanation for these skulls every which way, doesn't it? Are we expected to believe that these people secretly went inside the mother's womb and bound this baby skull when it wasn't looking or what? You know, this one picture alone proves beyond a doubt that the greater proportion of these elongated skulls were a matter of breeding and not skull binding. Let's take a look at a bit more evidence that undermines this theory of skull binding as well. Here we have a diagram of a normal human skull. As you will note from this diagram, humans have seams, what are called sutures, that come up the side of the head and also come up from the back of the skull. Pay particular notice of the fact that there is no frontal suture line on a human skull. To utterly disprove that these are simply skulls that were subject to the practice of skull binding, let's take a look at these elongated skulls, which have a very pronounced an indisputable frontal suture running from the bridge of the nose up the forehead to meet the other skull seams. Now, since these frontal sutures are not a part of normal human anatomy, then we are only led to one conclusion. These skulls and the beings who had them were not fully Earth human. There is no other conclusion. What you are looking at is a scientific and anatomical impossibility if these are only human skulls that came about as a result of skull binding. So you have to ask yourselves just who is lying to whom when you are faced with such empirical evidence, which science and academia flatly denies even exists. Is there really no empirical evidence to be found by our renowned scientists, as they claim can't be found when these pictures are viewed and these anomalous skulls obviously exist and were unearthed on this planet? I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but the evidence speaks in volumes on this score. I wonder what the dear old Darwinists have to say about this. So, let us continue down this uncomfortable road to revealing the truth that science and academia is hiding and denying. Let's take on the UFO crowd for just a minute, because many of them are agents of disinformation, always jumping at the shadows of the little gray alien abductors and cattle mutilators. Here is just a sample of what the UFO crowd are proposing about these elongated Anunnaki skulls. Given the fact that we have been so heavily indoctrinated and brainwashed with the whole gray aliens scenario, then it is really little wonder that this is the only conclusion that mind-controlled first cognition thinkers can come up with to try and account for these anomalous skulls. It kind of illustrates a form of selective blindness, if you ask me, but we are going to propose a completely different theory based on plenty of available evidence. Given the fact that the Anunnaki were fish-human hybrids and that they suffered many types of defects, even when they bred with humans, then when we look at images like these, we can start to get a clearer picture of what's going on. These statuettes are just a sample from ancient Mesopotamia. We all know that humans don't have large, oversized, round eyes. So just what are these statuettes supposed to represent? Artistic license? We're going to put forth this assertion. These are Anunnaki human hybrids with round black fish eyes, ladies and gentlemen. When you see those images and compare them with certain of these elongated skulls with overlarge eye sockets, it presents a totally different picture than the gray alien picture being pushed on the public. You will also